Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Give me some tips for not having jet lag.
Sure, easy. I can talk to that. I highly recommend definitely to avoid jet lag, you should take hardcore prescription drugs so you can sleep. It is the only way. I don't believe in jet lag. It's a state of mind anyway. I believe getting lots of sunlight. That's about it. That's all I got.
Sunlight.
Sunlight. Why sunlight? Like arrive, go for a walk.
Oh, okay.
Like the sunlight, apparently something to do with that helps your jet lag. Now, I was reading this, like you can get these like anti-jet lag glasses now.
Really?
That like project light at particular times like into your eyes to like trick your face into thinking it's in the right time zone.
Did not know that.
Yeah.
That sounds weirdly, what's the word? Artificial.
It's all weird.
Yeah.
I got nothing.
Okay. Okay, so drugs and sunlight.
Yeah, that's all I got.
Okay.
How's that?
In England, I reckon drugs are probably accessible, but sunlight.
Yeah, it's an issue.
Yeah, it's a
problem.
But flying out to Australia.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
You'll be fine at one way.
Exactly.
Okay.
Good times.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry podcast, episode 68. For those of you new to the show, my name is Simon Kane, and this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, TV, and today, the Fringe Circuit. Simon Abrahams is the creative director and CEO at the Melbourne Fringe. I got him on the podcast to talk about how the Fringe operates, how it helps non-Australian residents get visas to perform, the way the decline in print media has impacted promotions in Australia, and how to register a show from another country, and so much more. If you've ever wondered what it would be like or how it would be possible to take your show to the other side of the world and perform it, this is a podcast for you. It's largely comedy focused as always, but we do also talk broadly about other genres of performance that take place at the festival, so it should have a little bit of something for everyone. As always, please do remember to subscribe and join the Facebook group to get updates when new guests have signed up to get your chance to ask them questions. But without any more delays, this is Simon Abrahams.
So I am Simon Abrahams and I'm the creative director and CEO at Melbourne Fringe. Melbourne Fringe, if you don't know, is one of Australia's largest festivals. We have something like 6,000 artists in about 400 shows in 196 venues over 18 days, playing to about 350,000 people. And I've been there for just over a year. And before I was at Fringe, I've kind of done lots of weird and wonderful things. I worked in children's theatre, actually, for a long time, kind of at the pointy, experimental end of things. We did one tour of the UK. We did LIFT, which is the London International Festival of Theatre, with a season at the National, actually. But yeah, toured a lot sort of nationally and internationally, creating experimental kind of installation work for children. So I'm sort of at the opposite end of the scale now in a lot of ways. I've done, I also ran a Centre for Ideas, which is a very fun thing where every day, every single day, we had panel discussions essentially about kind of anything in the world. So, you know, I've kind of come from a theatre background to, yeah, the kind of world of literary programming and kind of books writing and ideas. And now I've kind of landed in a multi-art form festival across, you know, theatre, dance, music, visual art, comedy, kids' work, books writing and ideas. Yeah. Kind of a little bit of something for everybody.
Okay. And in terms of your role at the Fringe, so you said you're CEO and creative director, was it?
Yeah.
That's your job title.
Yeah.
So a lot of fringe festivals over here, you book through a sort of third party in between companies, shall we say. Yeah. So, for example, Laughing Horse, like, do a lot. I know they do a lot of festivals over in Australia. Do they do Melbourne? No. Okay. Ignore that. No, but they do. So they do a lot of fringe festivals over here, yeah, where you book with them, they give you a venue, and then you register centrally with the festival itself. Yeah. I mean, do you do all the bookings yourself? Is it because it sounds like you're curating the fringe yourself?
Good question. So Melbourne Fringe is an open access festival, which means, like Edinburgh, like Brighton, any artist can participate. So we have three streams to the program. We have the independent program, where anyone can come directly to us, which is what they tend to do. So sometimes they need a venue, so we might help find them a venue, but sometimes they come to us with a venue already on board, and then we, you know, kind of support their work. We also program venues ourselves. So we have artists that come to us and we program or curate them into our venues in what we call the festival hub, which is like the kind of, I guess, beating heart of Melbourne Fringe. And then we have a commissioned program. So we actually commission public artwork that kind of goes out and about in the city. So, you know, we have, yeah, kind of commissioned program, a curated program, and the open access program. And my job really, I guess, is to sit kind of, I guess, at the top of all of that. And then I have an amazing staff of people that kind of work across those programs. And we run a huge kind of artist development program as well for kind of emerging artists in particular.
So I assume you can be in more than one of those. So if anyone applied for the indie program,
yeah,
if you wanted to book them for one of your venues, it's not like one or the other, or is it allowed?
It probably would be one or the other. Not by definition or by a rule, but just sort of how it would tend to work in terms of our festival is 2.5 weeks. So if you're booked in for a season somewhere else, you probably wouldn't have time to come and do a season with us in the hub. So you tend to kind of choose one or the other, I guess.
So the seasons overlap between all three of those?
Yeah, it's all at the same time.
Oh, okay. So it's not like, so for example, with Edinburgh, you could do your own show at 2 o'clock, say,
yeah,
and then be on a variety bill for, say, the Pleasance at 5. Or yeah. Does it work like that?
Yeah, it could work like that. Okay, yeah. Sorry, I understand. Yeah, so conceptually, you could do something, but we tend to be, unlike Edinburgh, I guess we're not nearly as big. We have 400 shows. Edinburgh has, I don't know, 2,000 or something.
Billions.
Yeah. It's actually a trillion. So I guess most of our programming is at night. So, okay, you know, there wouldn't necessarily be huge capacity to, you know, kind of be in multiple venues across town. But it's possible if you really wanted to push it.
Okay.
I say bring it on.
Yeah. Well, push yourself.
Yeah.
So if most of your programming happens at night, does that mean that, so for example, if we compared it to Edinburgh, which is always a mistake because it's so different to
anything else.
But if we were to Edinburgh, you can do pretty much, I think it's from like 11 o'clock in the morning to 11 o'clock the next morning, you
yeah,
know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in terms of yours, is it that people don't take time off to come to it like they would do, like they'd do a holiday to Edinburgh and so they watch a day worth of shows, or is it a case of most of the audience are people coming from work maybe? Or
most people come from work, so okay, yeah, most of our shows start at kind of 6 o'clock or 6:15, right, and then go through till about midnight, I guess. And then on the weekends we might do daytime shows, but not a huge number of people would do a midweek show.
Okay.
But they could.
Okay.
Yeah, bring it on.
So over that 2.5 weeks, most of the shows are happening Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
No, in
the
we'll evenings. Run okay. every night.
Right.
Yeah, but just at night, basically.
Yeah. And by, I don't say by definition, but by extrapolation, would it be fair to say that much like most people over here in England, you know, most people don't like going out on a Monday, for example, because it's the first night of the week. Would you say there's sort of a bell curve of audience participation and going out, or do you think because it's a festival vibe?
Yeah, it really depends on the work itself, I think. A Monday is a quiet night, I guess. Tuesday, we often have half-price tickets, so Tuesday tends to have a surge. But, you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday are definitely our biggest. But, you know, we see people across every night of the week. It really depends on the work, the venue, the particular audience. We run across the school holidays in September, so you know we'll have family events, you know, during the day or in the early evening. So yeah, it really depends on the show and its particular audience.
Yeah, totally. And in terms of shows, do they prefer finished shows or work in progress or split shows between three or four performers, for example? What's the kind of feel for that?
Kind of everything, I guess. Across, you know, we have 400 shows, so we do have a massive mix. We get a lot of people, a lot of comedians, for example, who will try out new material in Melbourne. We have a pretty extraordinary audience at Melbourne Fringe who are massive risk takers compared to, you know, some of our sister festivals in Australia who tend to have I guess, more commercial acts sometimes, and audiences tend to flock to something that they know. Melbourne Fringe audiences are really happy to try out something new. So we often will get artists try out new material or sort of see, you know, work up, test something new, and then they might take it round on a tour for the, you know, 12 months after that. So we often get an extraordinary number of kind of premieres at our festival.
Okay, that's cool. And like you said, you call them your sister festivals.
Yeah.
So I assume there's no rivalry as such, because you're not really crossing over with each other.
Yeah. No, there's no real rivalry between the festivals from our perspective, because Melbourne Fringe is actually at the other end of the year to a lot of the big festivals that some of the UK artists might know. So we're in September and October, and a number of those artists might come and tour, say, the Perth Fringe or the Adelaide Fringe or the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, which are sort of in February, March, April. So, you know, we're kind of great friends, and we go and see all their work, and they come and see ours, and we kind of work in partnership, I guess, because we really don't see each other as competitors.
Okay. Do you know why you're positioned, or did you have a reason for being positioned in September?
We're 35 years old. I think partly it's just how things have always been.
Okay.
And the Melbourne International Comedy Festival is in April.
Okay.
So I guess we deliberately put ourselves 6 months apart to, you know, because we share often a lot of work or share some audiences. So we don't want to compete with each other. So, you know, I guess they take the first half of the year, and the Melbourne International Festival's at a similar time to us, and the Sydney Fringe is at a similar time to us. And there's almost kind of, you know, two ends. And we take the second half.
So the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, if you were to have a rival, would probably be that one, but only because it's the same location and more comedy focused than your one.
Yeah, I guess so. We're quite different in a sense. Yeah, they're a lot bigger than us. They're a lot more commercial than us, and they're just comedy. Whereas we're across kind of every art form. So yeah, we're good friends with them. Yeah, I suppose if we were on at the same time, perhaps we'd see each other as competitors. But you know, they're kind of great big brother, big sister to us. Yeah.
Okay, So if we discount the English festival circuit for now,
how
do you fit in? So say an Australian artist who was doing the festival circuit over there, how would you see your festival fitting in with the others? So like what? So for example, a lot of acts over here work to Edinburgh, if that makes sense. So they'll go around and build a show and then do it there.
Yeah.
And then maybe tour it or whatever.
Yeah.
Where does yours fit in for an act that maybe is just Australia-centric and then maybe one that wants to come over as well?
Yeah. Well, I guess in some ways the Australian equivalent to Edinburgh is Adelaide. You know, Adelaide Fringe is the second largest in the world after Edinburgh, and Perth Fringe is the third largest in the world after Adelaide. So we have two of the three largest festivals in the world, and there's definitely, I guess, a circuit, particularly for those two, because they're back-to-back or they're on at the same time, and they have a similar vibe in a sense, in some ways similar to Edinburgh of, you know, they are quite commercial, they're tent-based festivals, they're predominantly outdoors, so they do very well for circus, for comedy. They, I guess, are as much about the kind of temporary bars as they are about the work that's in them. They're about the whole experience. So a lot of artists will work towards that. There are huge audiences there and massive marketing budgets, and you can do very well. You know, of course, it's really difficult as well. Melbourne Fringe is a lot smaller. It's a lot friendlier. It's a lot edgier. It's a lot riskier. So we often find artists will see Melbourne Fringe as a time to experiment. They'll often test a new show with us, them, and then they'll take it to probably Perth, followed by Adelaide. But likewise, we get artists from interstate that come to us sort of the other way around. But, you know, we will often get artists try something new in Melbourne, take it the next year on the circuit, say Perth, Adelaide, Melbourne Comedy Festival, and then, you know, take it off to, say, Brighton Fringe and Edinburgh Fringe. And then that's sort of the 12 months are gone.
Yeah, you've just come from the Brighton Fringe.
I have.
Yeah. I mean, what's your relationship there? Do you use that for a scouting ground, or is that...
Yeah, I went to Brighton Fringe for the first time this time.
Okay.
Partly I just wanted to see it and understand it. And, you know, we're sort of a similar size in a sense. So it was interesting for me to get a sense of how that might work. And there's a number of Australians that perform there. So I wanted to kind of, just understand the context a bit better, and definitely to try and, you know, scout work and see what people are talking about and who's interesting. And that was great, actually.
And they have a free fringe model there. Do you have a free fringe model at yours?
We don't, no. No. So all of our work is ticketed, or it's completely free programming. But if it's free programming, there's sort of no expectation of, you know, payment, as the free fringe model often often kind of, you know, does work. So no, we're, I guess, a probably more traditional ticketed model. The kind of free fringe model doesn't really exist in Australia, actually. Yeah, even in Adelaide and Perth, it doesn't really exist.
So if you were to go over there and do a free show, most likely no one would actually pay at the end if you asked.
People wouldn't understand it. The culture doesn't, yeah, the culture doesn't exist. Okay. I think people would be like, I thought this was a free show,
okay.
You know? So yeah, the culture is different. People would expect to buy a ticket beforehand.
So would they be upset if they were asked at the end to contribute towards a show, or would it be...
I think it's just about context. Okay. I think if people understood kind of how it worked, you know, but certainly the festivals, you know, I guess I include myself in this, the festivals don't like to encourage it in particular, you know, because it ultimately can devalue the work of the artists. It, you know, we like to encourage people to pre-book. There's sort of lots of reasons, I guess, to try and capture as much ticketing data, which is useful for marketing purposes. So, you know, definitely we're trying to push people into ticket sales rather than put a coin in a bucket if we can. So
yeah, yeah. I read an article that said you saw 39% increase on ticket sales this year to last year. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, it was the year before to the year before that.
Oh, okay, yeah,
between 2014 and 2015.
Yeah,
we saw a 25% growth in artists participating, right, which led to a 39% increase in box office.
So in the correlation of that, was that more audience were coming because there were more shows, or was that still percentage-wise audience numbers for shows staying roughly the same? Do you know what I mean? Because if there's more shows, yeah.
More audiences were coming to more shows, so both of those things are true.
Okay.
So we had more shows in the festival by about 25%. There was a concern that the audience, you know, wouldn't increase to go with it, which is certainly what we've seen in some other festivals. And thankfully, that was not the case.
Okay.
So, you know, we saw more people coming because there were more shows, but also more, the percentage of tickets sold for each show was also higher. So may those numbers continue.
Yeah, yeah. How did you make that happen out of interest? What was the pull factor that kept that building?
It's an interesting question. We've kind of asked ourselves that a lot in terms of what drew such a significant increase in the number of artists wanting to participate. I mean, I do think, you know, there's been a consistency of strategy across the organisation that has really helped people to kind of understand, you know, what it is that we do, and why that can be a part of that and the benefits of that for them. I think, you know, we've probably just done a better job of kind of artist recruitment an artist call out and explaining people the benefits of fringe and that there's real audiences for them. And I think over time we're then seeing audiences come back time and time and time again. We've had some really strong programming, some brilliant artists, you know, a couple of big headline acts that can often really see a flow-on effect to a number of other, you know, smaller artists or companies as well.
And in terms of getting more audience numbers through, was that you putting more money into marketing, or was it just word of mouth? What built that up as well?
A combination of things. I mean, obviously over the last, say, 3 years, you know, we've really seen the rise in social media in a commercial sense. So we've really, you know, our followers have dramatically increased. We've really learned how to use that. You know, we've built up our kind of public presence as well with our kind of free public artwork, and that just builds a bit of momentum. We've got a really fab publicist who does a really great job, you know. So I think just a combination of things all kind of adding up.
So in terms of your learnings from social media, is that key to getting your show out over there? Like what are the main methods that people use to discover a new show?
Yeah, how do people find a new show or find a good show is sort of,
that's,
you know,
yeah,
that's the yeah, sort of the if I could bottle that, I'd sell it for a lot of money. I mean, you know, obviously in a place like Melbourne, you know, our audiences want risky, great, amazing, brilliant work. And something really edgy and interesting will earn a reputation, you know, very quickly within days. I mean, there's audiences just desperately trying to find out. And Twitter is definitely a huge part of that. You know, the buzz goes out very quickly. People will kind of talk about shows they've seen and just, you know, the Melb Fringe hashtag. And you can follow that pretty quickly and get a pretty good sense of it. You know, the kind of critical reviews and critical engagement is, you know, relatively dire, which I think is sort of true around the world from what I can see. We're seeing more and more column inches cut, you know, and obviously some of it's moving online, but there's then such an enormous amount of it, it's incredibly difficult to know who to trust. And, you know, that's just the nature of the modern, you know, contemporary media. But, you know, for us, in terms of, you know, finding a work, it's definitely that kind of Twitter buzz and word of mouth and people being in the club and turning up and just kind of going, you've got to see this show, this one's amazing. And then as shows start to sell out, people want those ones.
Yeah.
You know, I always recommend, better to sell out a small venue than you know, have the same number in a massive venue, that sold out sign will do wonders for your box office.
Yeah, my first Edinburgh, I did a room that had, I think it was 15 or 16 capacity.
Perfect.
And yeah, and well, I was not, you know, in anyone, so I'm still not. But the thing is that like the first day it filled, and then we'd turn away people, and that kept building every day because people would tell their friends and say, we can't get in, and it's only a 16 seater, but for some reason they hadn't clocked onto that, and so we had like queues on the stairs, and at one point we were getting in trouble because there was a bit of a fire hazard because it was like too many people, and we were like, we haven't flyered, this is weird. So yeah, I can understand but also it's kind of when I spoke to Mick Perrin about this, Mick Perrin's a touring agent over here, he put it down quite succinctly. We said, is the venue bigger than your ego? Try and place it that way.
Yeah.
And I suppose, for example, if someone wanted to come over and they wanted to try and pick a venue, would you, and you said you sort of help out with that for the indie people, how does that work for someone who doesn't live there? So is it a case of a Skype chat, an email correspondence? What kind of support can you give someone that can't just pop over and have a look at rooms?
Yeah, we do a lot to help artists find spaces. I mean, we know most of them. And, you know, we really try and match artists, I guess, on a curatorial basis of where their work fits best, you know, because we're across every art form. So some of our venues, you know, really have reputation for contemporary dance or, you know, for live music or for experimental theatre or for straight down the line theatre or for stand-up comedy or, you know, anything in between, for live art work. So, you know, we really try and get a sense of you know, if they're commercial, a bit more commercial, they'll go on a different venue to if there's something a bit more experimental. So we try and match them up with just where we think the fit is best. And then, you know, size is definitely a part of that. You know, we have spaces from, you know, about 15 to, you know, our biggest sort of standard venue is about 300. And we have sort of everything in between. So, you know, definitely, you know, something like a 30-seater, you know, is really great, I think, for a lot of artists. It feels great. You can get about 12 people in there and it feels good, but, you know, gives you somewhere to go as well.
Yeah, yeah. And what do you know what the average ticket price is for show? Do you have, like, a standard, you know, everything in the comedy section is this or everything in the drama section is this? How does pricing work, or does the artist just work it out for themselves?
Yeah, we don't have any standard ticket pricing, so it's the artist is empowered to do whatever they like.
Okay.
Our standard ticket price is just over 20 Australian dollars, which is roughly £10.
Okay.
So pretty cheap. And kind of because of that, we encourage people, you know, a third of the festival is free. A lot of visual artwork, a lot of kind of public art. So a lot of our music is free, you know, gigs, and people just, you know, buy alcohol, and that's how, you know, the venue makes their money. We really encourage people to, you know, do what they want to do and kind of see where it lands, and we encourage our audiences to go and see something for free and go and buy a ticket to someone that they might have heard of, but only on condition they buy a ticket to something completely new. And over the course of the night, you've only spent, you know, $40, which is, say, 20 quid, and you've seen four shows and, you know, learned something new about yourself.
That's pretty interesting. So exchange rate wise, $20 is about £10.
Yeah.
And
at the moment.
At the time of recording. It could change.
Used to be much better, and it'll probably get much worse if it continues on this route. Much better for me.
Yeah. But I'm just wondering, in terms of outside of fringe time for ticketed shows, is that average? Like, what kind? Because if over here it's a minefield trying to, like, work out your pricing, especially when you're doing it for yourself. To do that and factor in, you know, sort of conversion costs and all that kind of stuff, without even knowing what the rough costs are outside of fringe time. I mean, I don't want to get too much into the economy of Australia, but is that, like, what people would expect when they see, so for example, if I saw a show for 20 quid over here, obviously it's not just a tenner, but if I saw it for 20 quid, that would imply a certain level of comedian. Is it like 20 bucks is just not change, but it's like a disposable income that would make sense for them if they were doing a run of shows to go and see a festival?
Yeah, I suppose $20, so yeah, about 10 quid would be, I mean, it's considered cheap.
Okay.
You know, so I guess, you know, a leading comedian, you could easily pay double that.
Okay.
Easily pay $40, £20. So, yeah, prices during Fringe tend to be less. But then I guess your venue costs are often less because you're sharing a venue. Mm. So there's sort of pros and cons of it. And obviously there's kind of audiences and various kind of marketing opportunities that come with being as part of a festival. But, it's considered cheap. Yeah. Mm.
And what are the costs obviously that'll fluctuate, and this is today, if that makes sense. But what are the costs for a performer to, other than flights and things like that, to register with you to do a show? Like, what are the kind of processes to get? So say I've registered with the Indie Guide, the Indie Program. After that point, I come to you and I have to be in the program, or you don't have to be in the program, or you sign up to an app. What's the process there?
Sure. So any artist can be part of the independent program. They come to us. They pay. What they pay varies a little bit depending on how many performances and whether it's free if they have a small capacity. And we're sort of quite generous in a lot of ways. Okay. But assuming they're doing a full run in a normal venue of a full season, it's just under $400, about 200 quid. That essentially gets you included in the guide and on the website and in the program and access to our team. We have an artist services team who kind of can help you every step of the way. And then on top of that, you pay venue hire depending on your venue, and there's a small ticketing charge that comes out of every ticket that's sold as well. So, but roughly, more or less, once you've paid your money, you're then kind of free to do what you want to do.
Okay, and your venue services, do they help people get to Australia? I know it sounds weird, but if you've never booked a flight there, I mean, you were telling me just before we started, do you say you've got like two stopovers on your way back, or it's not a direct flight necessarily?
No, no flight in the world that can fly 24 hours.
No. And also it's a long time to be traveling, and also it's an expensive, sort of route over there. So do you, a lot of like festivals over here, for example, have local businesses they work with, so you can get a cheap hotel, for example, if you're a performer. Do you have any sort of artist services that kind of help with that?
Yeah, we do. We have a whole team that basically there to help every step of the way, our artist services team. So they can kind of help, provide. We do have a hotel sponsor who offers a kind of cut rate, although for a lot of artists it's still probably more than they want to pay. They tend to just do Airbnb or something super super cheap. Hostel is often kind of what they choose to do. Our artist services team will help, kind of every bit. There's some visa things that have to be sorted out that our team can help with as well.
I was talking to I've forgotten their name from the Vancouver Fringe, and they have a really interesting model where if you put up an artist, you get like a pass to go to a lot of the shows for free. Do you have anything like that there?
But that's a great idea.
Yeah, I just thought it was a really interesting model for especially if someone, if they're going all the way there, you get free accommodation, they get free tickets. It kind of...
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we don't have that system, but I might steal that.
Well, you heard it here first. Now there's no pressure on him to do it, but there definitely is. You have several sponsors then? Because I know Bank of America is the main one, isn't it? Bank of Australia, sorry.
Yep.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm thinking of America. Let me do it again.
America is no use to me. Bank Australia is our principal partner.
Okay.
They are amazing. They're an ethical bank.
Okay.
So every account holder is a part owner, part shareholder in the bank.
Really?
So all of their profits are... either returned back to the members, to the account holders, and also a proportion of that is distributed to the community. So they do things like if you buy a new home, get a home loan, they will plant a certain number of trees to offset the carbon of the purchase of the home. So they're really amazing, and they're a great kind of ethical fit for us, I guess. And they give us, a really substantial... amount of money that, helps us put on the festival. And also, it's not an act of charity for them. I mean, it's also a way that they can help, I guess, spread the word about what they do and talk to our audiences. And we've both done quite a lot of market research and found there's a really great overlap between our target audiences. And, it's just a really very happy marriage. We've been together 3 loving years, and we've just signed on for another 3 years. So, it's a really, really great, amazing partnership.
Has it changed? Like, have they adjusted it at all for the next 3 years, or is there?
Yeah, it's all going in the right direction, which is how we want it.
Okay, cool. And what does a sponsorship deal mean for performers? Is it like, do they like sponsoring the arts? Do they like helping out with that? Or do they offer, you know, something like cheaper exchange rates, for example, on money or anything like that that helps out?
The sponsorship you know, helps the festival, which in turn helps the artist by helping us keep registration fees down. They do this amazing thing where they allow their customers to get discounted tickets, but they pay the discount. The artist still gets the full price of the ticket, but the audience member gets a discount ticket, and the bank makes up the difference. So they do things like that, which are really amazing. So it's kind of everyone wins.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So again, is that just because they want people to sign up to accounts and sort of put money in? So it's again, not completely altruistic on their part, but
it's amazing. I mean, it's a marketing tool for them, essentially, yeah. They believe in what we do, but, you know, also, of course, they want to build their brand and want people to know that they are doing amazing work, which they are. And so, you know, we tried to think together about clever ways we could help spread the message. And that was sort of one idea that we had. And they said yes.
Cool. And do you have awards over there?
Yes.
What is the structure for those and how does that work?
So we have lots of awards and they all work in sort of slightly different ways. So we have art form based awards. Mm-hmm. So we have a very, actually quite a rigorous system of judging by kind of artistic peers. So we will ultimately kind of award in a single award for the best work in each art form across the whole festival. We then have a number of professional development awards that are mostly targeted at young and emerging artists, and they tend to have a partner involved. So they're a mentor.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Tourships, there's, you know, space to develop work, there's all sorts of kind of, you know, awards that are provided across kind of particular cultural groups. So we have an award for the best kind of multicultural artist or the best indigenous artist, or, you know, yeah, a lot of emerging, you know, new experimental work or kind of development awards. Then we have touring awards. So we have kind of reciprocal touring awards with the moment Adelaide Fringe, Perth Fringe, New Zealand Fringe, the Brisbane Powerhouse, PACT, which is a centre in Sydney. And we essentially, yeah, they come and they choose a work that they like and they guarantee to pick it up for a tour. So, you know, we do the same kind of, we go to their venues and their festivals and bring something back. So we all kind of know that we're a certain amount of work will tour at the end of the festival as well.
So you're talking about a tour of Australia?
That's right. Yeah, okay. Or New Zealand.
Okay,
which is a whole different country.
Yeah. No, I was going to ask if it was like a tour, as in next year they go around the other festivals, or whether it's a tour of, you know, sort of indie theatres, or how that sort of operates. Yeah.
So there's sort of lots of different things. We do some kind of regional touring, as in regional Australia into theatre venues. But mostly, yeah, we set up these tours into other festivals across the country and New Zealand.
Okay. And outside of the fringe, what is the comedy scene like? So what would you, and also how, what's your relationship like with that? So the sort of circuit of clubs or acts that are doing shows?
It's a good question. We tend to, we have a more distant relationship than the Melbourne Comedy Festival does, because we're across every art form. So, you know, comedy tends to come to a head in kind of April, and then again for us in September. You know, there are certainly venues that operate year round, but, you know, there's no doubt that it is really at those kind of two points of the year that kind of, the real comedy work comes up. So, you know, we do a lot of scouting in April, which is during the comedy festival, Melbourne Comedy Festival. That's when we're really out seeing who's hot and who's interesting and who's up and coming.
And where else do you also scout? Well, Brighton a bit and Edinburgh, I assume?
Yeah, we actually find it quite hard to get to Edinburgh, because it's literally like 2 weeks before our festival opens, which is the busiest time to fly to the other side of the world.
Yeah.
So, we tend to go, Adelaide, Adelaide, Perth, as I say, I was just in Brighton, New Zealand. Yeah, venues right across town.
Yeah, I should give you an intro to the Leicester people thinking about it, because they're in February, so that could work perfectly.
That would be great.
Yeah. So, in terms of beyond social media to promote a show, what are your relationships like with like local press and radio stations and TV stations and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. So we have really great relationships with radio in particular. We have a really amazing publicist. There's two radio stations actually that kind of partner with us and have done for years and years. One is called Triple R. It's the kind, I don't know what the equivalent would be here. It's the kind of independent media. And, you know, they play a lot of indie bands and, you know, they really support the arts and they're amazing. And then Joy, which is the queer radio station. And both of them kind of are really amazing at supporting our festival. You know, we have a great publicist who does really amazing work in terms of press across town. There's only two main papers in Melbourne, and both of them are kind of, you know, printed papers that are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, which I think is a common story all around the world as kind of print media kind of dies. So there's no doubt that getting space in those two publications is getting more and more difficult. There's The Australian, which is a national publication, which tend to focus only on national issues. And then we have The Guardian is online only in Australia and sources a lot of its content from over here. So, you know, press can be hard.
So the two newspapers don't have an online presence?
They do.
Oh, okay.
They do, but yeah, they're still sort of, I don't know if it's the same over here, but it's interesting just watching both of them really struggle with, particularly there's one newspaper that in some ways its readership aligns most closely with our market. I don't know what the equivalent would be here. Slightly left-leaning, but probably not as far left as The Guardian.
Right.
I don't know what your equivalent would be here. But, you know, they're just seeing their audience kind of be, you know, kind of whittled away, and they're struggling to kind of work out that move, I think, to online. And I think it's a really common story all around the world.
Yeah, I think it's not dead, but it's just moving online. Which, I mean, I suppose that means the actual antiquatedness of, like, the physical thing's dead. But the problem is that there's still sort of a dying generation that like it. And I don't know. I think it's just going to end at some point.
Well, it definitely will end. But it's interesting also, you know, with the online media, we curate it much more. You don't do that just flicking through the paper and seeing what you find. People tend to really follow links. It's harder to be exposed to stories in a sense. People sort of flick through on their phone and click on something or not. Whereas I think in a printed paper, people tended to waft through the paper and see what they found. Whereas now, you know, yeah, people are time poor. They're, you know, used to being very, very clear in what they want, and they curate their social media feeds to get the kind of story they want to see. So, you know, there can be 100 reviews of shows on in an online paper, but unless you kind of click on the right button, they won't come up. Whereas if you flicking through the paper and there's a whole page of reviews, you tend to at least understand that the festival's on, you know. So I think there's some challenges associated with it. But look, there's lots of pros that come with that as well. And, you know, much more targeted media and all the things that I just said are negative or positives as well, as people get exactly what they want and they know what they're looking for and all of that.
And in terms of radio, because you've got good relationship there, is that because your audience or a lot of the people listen to radio more over in Australia, or is that, you know, just the connection that you've built? So, you know, just because that's the one you've been working on the most, what's the?
Yeah, it's a good question. I feel like radio, Melbourne Fringe just has a kind of great relationship with radio and has for a long time. Okay. I'm not a huge radio listener, so sometimes I'm shocked. I do a lot of radio kind of interviews and stuff, you know, when I'm flogging the festival, I guess. And I'm always shocked at how many people tell me they've heard me on the radio. So it definitely works. People definitely listen to it, but I'm never sure why.
I met someone at a gig recently who overheard me and came running over and went, "I know your voice." And I was like, "Okay, this is a bit weird." And they went, "No, I listened to this." And I was like, "Oh, that's nice." And they
Creaky,
went, "Yeah,
but nice."
Yeah, but I was like, "Oh, I just didn't know what you looked like." And I was like, "Thanks." That's nice, I suppose. But it was just a bit surreal where, because I don't have me on this anywhere at the moment anyway, it's sort of weird that they know this voice but they don't know what I look like. And I suppose this is the same, you know, like, is it they sort of don't, are you sort of behind the scenes, not on purpose, but like, because your voice is only going out there on radio, so do you sort of like to stay, I don't want to say below the radar, but just not, you, so you can walk along and not get stopped like a performer might, for example? Or is it,
yeah, I'm not quite Beyonce, so okay. You know, I can definitely walk down the street. I think ours is a different, I think ours is a different sort of festival to a lot of festivals that have, I guess, a lead curator who's very well known, especially if you look at some of the international festivals here. They've got, you know, kind of a big celebrity, but, you know, we're really driven by the artists. That's our real focus. All the artists would know who I am and what I do, but I don't know if the broader community sort of would. Yeah.
Yeah, and flyering is quite a big thing in most festivals over here. Is it a thing over there?
Flyering is not a thing in Melbourne. Okay. It's not a thing at all. In fact, it is banned.
Really?
It is a local bylaw. Actually can't do it. And we have quite a strong environmental policy, both in terms of the festival itself, but also the City of Melbourne, who fund us. The City of Melbourne have very strong environmental frameworks that we have to adhere to. So, in fact, you know, we kind of think it's bad for the environment. Most of them go in the bin. The way that the printing structures work is it costs you the same amount of money to print 10,000 as it does to print 50,000. So everyone prints 50,000, but they only needed 10. You know, none of that actually, you know, helps anyone. So, yeah, we really discourage people. Certainly standing on the street handing out flyers is not something you're really allowed to do. The Melbourne Comedy Festival get a special permit, and you can do it in a very particular zone.
That everyone avoids,
exactly.
Yeah.
But we sort of discourage it at Melbourne Fringe. We think it's bad for the environment.
I agree. No, I avoid flyering at every festival that I can, just because I don't like doing it, and B, I mean, that's not true actually. I like talking to people, but I don't like giving them something at the end of it, because it feels then like I've been sales pitching, which I suppose I have been, but I prefer not doing that.
And just your soul, like, think about your soul. All of that handing out of flyers to people that are not interested is soul destroying.
Well, yes, but you don't know if they're not interested until you've spoken to them. Especially in someone like Edinburgh, where I've found, you know, sometimes I've spoken to people who are flyering and they've gone, like, I've seen them not flyer someone and I've gone, "Why didn't you give them one?" or whatever. And they're like, "Oh, they wouldn't enjoy it." And you think, how do you know from looking at that person? I mean, you might for some people, but how do you know from looking that they aren't going to like your style of comedy? It seems a bit presumptuous on their part.
Or maybe like a snap judgment, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And maybe they're more worried that they will like it and it'll be like, "Oh, I'm attracted to that." So it could be even something within them that's quite negative and dark. But I don't like flyering, so that's good to hear in a weird way. So is posters the same thing, where you can't really put them up in venues, or is that?
Posters can go up. So posters, there's kind of a mafia of show posters in Australia.
Okay.
Where essentially companies, I don't know if it's the same over here, where like companies buy walls in cafes and things. And then the only way you can get a poster on a wall is to pay the person who's rented the wall.
Yes.
And they all hate each other, like the different companies that do it. Right. So if you go with one, never darken the door of the other.
Yeah, no, in Edinburgh, they you put them up in all the free venues and stuff that you want, but the walls of most of the buildings, you have to pay an extortionate amount to have a big one of your face on it.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much that helps, because I think after a certain period of time, they all blend in and you don't sort of notice them anymore.
Well, it is that thing ultimately where, you know, an image is what sells a show. Mm. When there's that many to choose from, you know, just another face that you don't know isn't going to do enough, probably. You know, it really needs to be something incredibly clever that can really stand out, that makes people stop and look. Mm. And I think if you can come up with an image that, you know, really is quite extraordinary, then a poster campaign can be really effective in terms of building awareness. I don't know that it will translate into ticket sales, but step one of ticket sales is building awareness. So I think it does help people know that a show is on. Mm. There's another stage of marketing that is about convincing people to buy a ticket.
Are stunts a thing over there? Because in Edinburgh, that's quite a big thing, where they even have awards for the most intelligent or most crafty stunt. So do you allow that, or do you encourage that? What's your...
We neither discourage stunts or encourage stunts, but we don't really have a huge number of them, I must say. Okay. We tend to have... So we run a central club, and a lot of acts will ask to perform at the Fringe Club, and it's where a lot of artists and audiences will kind of come to find out, you know, what's hard and what's interesting, and just have a great night. So yeah, a lot of artists will do something wacky there, but it's not a stunt as such.
Okay. And you mentioned before, or we've talked a little bit about ticket sales. How far in advance do Melbourne audiences book shows? Because I've done shows where I've been called by the promoter like 2 days before, and they've said only 4 tickets have been sold. Do you want to pull it, kind of thing? And I've gone, no, we'll do it. And then on the day you get, you know, just a surge of people turning up, or maybe not surge, but you know, you get people turning up and you've worried yourself for no reason, if that makes sense. Whereas, you know, for festivals, I have friends of mine who are already booking their Edinburgh shows, you know, like tickets for that now. So I'm wondering, like, how organized are your audience, I suppose, is the question.
Our audiences at Melbourne Fringe are pretty disorganized.
Okay. It's good to hear.
Yeah, we don't get a huge number of pre-sales before the festival begins. Really? But we do get a lot of bookings. So artists don't, or audiences don't necessarily just buy on the night. Like, they do book tickets, but they wait and hear what's hot. Mm. So we launch our festival 5 weeks before we open, and, you know, we would only sell, I don't know the numbers, 20% of tickets in that time. You know, most of the tickets really are sold once the festival begins, and once people really start to hear what's hot and what's interesting. It would only be a really big name artist or a big name comedian that would sell out in advance. Most really happen during the festival.
Would it make sense then to, I mean, I know you're probably going to say no, just from a logistic point of view, but wouldn't it make sense then for some performers to start slightly later on for different genres of performance? Because if the tickets don't start selling until they know, would you, and it costs you more to do a certain number of more shows. I'm just wondering whether it would make sense to do a shorter run later in the festival when people are booking stuff than...
It's kind of pros and cons to it. I mean, we sell lots of tickets at the start. It's not that we only sell tickets at the end. We encourage people to do a full run, actually, because it's just that audiences don't necessarily make up their mind. I think if you do a short run at the end, you can just get lost. Okay. Because by that stage, audiences have already decided what the hot show of Fringe is, mm-hmm. you know, whereas at the start of the festival, people are much more willing to experiment. Okay. So I think it depends who you are, you know. If you're a big name, you can probably do whatever you like. You can book at the start, at the end, in the middle, the whole run, and you'll sell. I think if you're, for want of a better term, a nobody, and, you know, really kind of, you know, working out who you are for the first time and trying to, I guess, build new audiences, you know, I really encourage people to do a full 2 week run or 2.5 week run and, you know, let that discovery happen. And probably your sales for the first bit might be a little bit slow, but they will pick up. And if you don't start by doing a full run, then they can often just never, you know, not pick up. I think that giving people a chance to come back and word of mouth to spread, it's a really common strategy, but, you know, I really encourage people to do the full run.
Yeah, and your participant services, what do you think are the most underused features or facilities that they offer that maybe performers just don't know about or just haven't had, you know, just haven't had a appropriate or what they think is an appropriate time to ask that you offer?
Good question. I feel like our artist services get absolutely slammed prior to registration.
Okay.
So
when's registration? How far ahead do you have to register?
We close registrations at the end of May, and the festival starts in the middle of September. So prior to that, when people are trying to find venues, I think in particular, they're trying to get themselves sorted there. When you register, I think it's the same over here. You know, by the day you register, you need to know your venue, your times, your dates, your ticket prices, your 60-word marketing blurb. You've got to have an image. So we get a lot of questions from people at that point when they're like, oh, my image needs to be 60 pixels and mine's only 45. What do I do? Whatever. I don't know if that's how many pixels it should be or even what a pixel is, but someone in my office does. And I guess I would encourage people that, you know, once you've registered, that's just the start, you know. Yeah, a lot less will during the course, call our marketing team and say, what tips have you got for me? Or, you know, I'm on the way to working on this. What do you think? Or my venue gave me this contract and could you have a look at it for me? Or, you know, our team's just kind of there to help.
Yeah, and I can imagine when it comes to promoting a show as well, are they good for... Because if the audiences are not as organised as maybe they are in other places, let's say that. If you started promoting as soon as you've been confirmed, that's sort of a 5-month gap when I'm presuming that's not going to have a very big impact on, even though the tickets will be available, I'm presuming most people aren't doing this. So, I mean, how far ahead do you plan media stuff if you're an artist?
So we have an embargo on our artists from registration until launch. And that is so that we could launch with a bang and kind of hit the media and tickets go on sale and we do everything on the same day. So this year we'll launch on the 9th of August, so it's 5 weeks before opening. So between registering on the 23rd of May, we close registrations, and the 9th of August, we ask our artists to shut up. And then basically on the 9th of August, we go live with a massive bang and suddenly here's the program, these are the artists, everything's on sale now, go. And we do that to try and sort of push it in that campaign period.
Are you penalized then if you do talk about it or you promote it? Or
I don't sort of fine people for it, you know, but I guess we discourage people to really do that because we just kind of think that nothing tends to be gained by it, really. You know, we sort of think that moment when artists or when audiences pick up that fringe guide and find out what's in the festival, we just think if that can happen with a bang, it just has a better effect on audiences and on sales. You know, a lot of artists come to us and ask if they can launch early. They do that for all sorts of reasons. They might be running a crowdfunding campaign. They might be part of a season in a venue that is launching a whole season. You know, they might have a particular strategy they're working on where they want to do an early bird ticket or, I don't know, something, you know. We give kind of permission for artists to break the embargo for lots of reasons, but, you know, we prefer it when they don't.
Yeah, of course. And in terms of, so if a lot of your audience are finding out stuff through the radio and the social media and that kind of stuff, and obviously the print media is getting less because of just everything is, you know, going online and it's not happening that way. Is there a reason why you still do a printed program? Like, is that because people are, you know, still looking at that? Or is it just traditionally you doing it so you carry it on?
Yeah, we've talked a lot about whether a printed program remains a useful thing. Our market research tells us that it is, that audiences still like to thumb a program guide and see what's on. But obviously, you know, we don't do that alone. Everything's also on a website that works on your phone and does all of that. So, you know, we find the combination of things works really well.
Okay. Yeah. I just wondered what's the split of discovery over your website versus program versus, have you got an app?
We don't know.
Okay.
We just use a mobile enabled website.
Cool.
Yep. Kind of all does the same thing. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. It's probably sitting in some statistics somewhere in terms of, you know, how they found out about it. It'll be in our market research, but off the top of my head, I don't know. I know we've certainly looked at, is it worth us still doing it? You know, and it is. And also by the time, you know, we sell ads in the guide too. So by the time we sell ads and stuff, it sort of can make back a lot of its money as well.
These are the final quickfire questions. So they're quick for me. You take as long as you want to do. Okay. What is the best show you've ever seen?
The best show I've ever seen.
I keep it vague on purpose, so it can be any medium of performance. It doesn't necessarily have to be comedy, although that would be the preference.
The best show I've ever seen probably is, it was a Belgian show. It was a Belgian one-on-one performance called Smile Off Your Face that has been very memorable for me, where you're in a wheelchair And you are kind of you as a participant. You're in a wheelchair and you're kind of moved and blindfolded and kind of moved through this kind of whole experience. And it certainly made me, you know, kind of, yeah, experience kind of work like I never had before. In terms of comedy, I'm definitely a massive Dr. Brown fan.
Oh, Dr. Brown, yeah. Is that, wait, is that Dr. Brown the rapper or Dr. Brown the clown?
Dr. Brown the clown.
Oh, yeah, he's awesome.
He's great.
Yeah, I did his clowning course a little while ago.
Did you?
Yeah, he's amazing. Yeah, yeah, I'd highly recommend it. Just even if you, do you perform much or are you?
Not very well.
Okay, yeah, just do it anyway. It's a lot of fun and it's really eye-opening, so yeah, it's amazing. Who do you think is the most underrated person in the industry? In fact, I'm going to narrow it down for you. I'm going to say the Australian industry.
I just need a second to think about it.
That's okay.
A good question.
It's my favourite one.
It's great.
Yeah.
I really love... I do love a kind of musical comedian.
Okay.
And we have a number of them in Australia that poised, I guess, for, you know, some big things, I think. Yeah, I particularly love a kind of comedy duo. I don't know if they've made it over here. Sammy J and Randy. I've known them both for years. So Sammy J is a kind of skinny blonde man and Randy is a small purple puppet, and they are, you know, kind of filthy and hilarious and clever and witty and political and, yeah, really, really kind of multi-skilled. The dear friend of Randy, who kind of, you know, the puppeteer, is an extraordinary performer, kind of an amazing puppeteer, and, you know, Sammy's a you know, great kind of fierce intellect. They're a pretty amazing duo.
Awesome. What is the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you overcome it?
Biggest mistake I've ever made. I've made so many. It's very hard. I took a job once that I took for the wrong reasons. I think I took it because it was quite powerful. They're the kind of jobs that people, you know, want for lots of reasons, but, you know, you've got a big programming budget, you know, in a big prestigious venue where everyone's always sucking up to you, and it was just a massive mistake. You can't take risks in a lot of those environments. You know, it was full of, you know, deeply conservative thinking when I'm a kind of fast-moving risk taker. And, you know, you kind of, I guess what I learnt at the end of that, you know, was really what are the things that I value. And I kind of, in every job or anything I've ever done since, I think a lot about the things that I value, and they are, you know, I value risk taking. I value integrity. You know, I value kind of good fun at the same time as good practice. You know, I value kind of seemingly making impossible things happen. I value flexibility. You know, I value bravery. And I think there's something about being able to identify what it is that you're after in the world that makes you realize who it is you want to associate with and what kind of organizations are the right fit.
Yeah. Last year I heard, I got told a thing that you are the average of the five people you hang out with most, which I think is really true. So I think when you think of it like that, you really select not just what you do, but who you're around much more carefully.
Absolutely. You know, I think we have to think about inspiration every single day. And, you know, there's just a lot of thought about, you know, kind of going, what do I want to get out of today? Mm. You know, do I want to kind of, what do I want my legacy to be? Do I want my legacy to be that I filled out the most paperwork, you know, most carefully? Or do I want my legacy to be, you know, that I enabled something extraordinary to happen, you know, that I built, you know, a kind of creative or artistic program that, you know, has kind of shifted the industry in some way or kind of supported artists to make something that they couldn't have made before or to reach a larger audience or, you know, to kind of push the boundaries of the art form or, you know, there's sort of some big questions I think we need to ask ourselves every day.
Yeah, definitely. What is the most interesting thing you do that nobody ever gets to see?
The most interesting thing that I do that nobody gets to see is probably the commissioning of new artworks. So they see the end product of that, but they don't see the process that goes behind it. So I'm very lucky in a sense that we have a commissioning program for public art. You know, we commission sculptures or free public performance or all sorts of things. So there's a kind of deep process where I'm talking to artists and we dream up kind of how we could impact the city. You know, we talk a lot about what we call cultural democracy, the idea that art is for everyone and that it's really the right of the citizens of our city to contribute to it. And I really think about that when I'm approaching the commissioning of a new artwork by an amazing, brilliant artist. And so I get to talk to a range of artists about how they want to, I guess, enable the citizens of our city to discover and rediscover their city in a way they haven't seen it before, or kind of look at their architecture in new ways, or, you know, kind of transform their civic spaces. And of those heaps and heaps of conversations, you know, one project might get up in a festival, but, you know, I get to have all these amazing, inspiring, incredible conversations with artists.
That sounds really nice. That sounds like a great job.
It's a pretty good job.
Yeah, I was going to say. What is the best bit of advice you've ever been given? And it doesn't have to be something you've used, by the way. I always have to make that clear to people.
The best bit of advice I've ever been given, I think it's always just, it's been to make sure that we understand that good work can go together with having a good time. There's a sense sometimes that unless you're being very serious, that your work isn't of value or isn't, yeah, you don't take it seriously. You know, I believe that you can have, you know, a deep conversation about, you know, finance or politics or anything while walking around the room clucking like a chicken. You know, I think things that make us laugh make us happier people out in the world. And, you know, I really try and make, you know, my workplace, my personal life, you know, a place where people want to be around you because they laugh. And that can go with a really deep commitment to, you know, kind of great practice as well.
Yeah, definitely. And if you could give one bit of advice to a performer who has never done the Melbourne Fringe before but is looking into it, what would that be?
Piece of advice I would give to a performer coming to Melbourne Fringe for the first time obviously would be do it. You know, especially if they're over here in the UK. Come all the way to Australia. I would say be prepared for, you know, a wild ride with a risky audience. You know, my piece of advice would be don't be boring. Don't do the standard conservative thing. You know, think about a work that can happen in a site-specific venue or that, you know, is really going to push people's buttons or is really at the edges of, you know, what we can even imagine. I think, you know, that certainly in Melbourne, the work that really blows people's minds is what we want to see. It's what we get excited about. It's what our audiences are up for. So I really encourage people to just think outside that box.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
My pleasure.
That was Simon. I hope you enjoyed that. He had such a passion for the shows and for the Fringe that really came through to me in the edit and also in real life. And I just loved how aware he was about the festival's place, both on the Australian circuit and the global one as well. Learning why they don't have a free Fringe and the expansion in social media really opened my eyes to the differences in culture from the other side of the world and has given me a little push to make an effort to go over there and perform shows to the Australians when I can afford it. If you got some value out of it and you think you might know someone else who could get some value out of it, please do share the link with them. It really helps with the show and the number of downloads and also just expands the audience to new people. Also, if you have a minute, please do give it an honest review in iTunes. That really helps out with the chart positions, or so I've been told, and it also just looks better for new people who land on it randomly. And finally, if you want to donate, you can do so through my website, either as a one-off donation via PayPal or as an ongoing donation per podcast via Patreon from $1 or 80p an episode. All the details and links are on the website in the show notes, which can be found at simonkane.co.uk. But for now, thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. Thank you very much for donating if you do. And I will see you all in about 10 days' time. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.